You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to Food Matters Live Table Talk podcast, where we'll be going one step further in the exploration of food tech innovations from around the world. Hearing from investors, startups and corporates as we take a look at the breakthrough technologies disrupting the food and drink landscape. What are the major trends we're looking to solve with tech? Who are the disruptors of the future and what are the innovations looking to take on some of the biggest sustainable challenges? To help us answer all these questions, we'll be hearing from food tech advisors, brands and investors. I'm Jo Kirkland, and joining the discussion on Table Talk today are Chris Fung, ex-CEO of Crush, board advisor and investor in food tech, Alessio Dantino, founder and CEO of Forward Fooding, and Zina Mavroidi, managing director of eFresh. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you
for joining me. Zina's joining us from Greece.
Hello.
Wonders of technology. So she's here virtually with us, joining the conversation. So let's dive straight in. So, Chris, you were the former CEO of Crush and now advise and invest in disruptive high-growth food and food tech businesses. Tell us about Crush and your current work.
Well, Crush has been a healthy eating chain. It's been started in London back in 98. We've been going strong for 20 years. There's about 30 or 35 sites now, something like that. I ran it for about 13 years, stepped out a couple of years ago, and really have been focused on looking at the food and food tech sort of side of things. You know, been pretty excited about what's going on in that space.
Tell us a bit about what's going on. Exciting you?
Well, I guess I'm involved in probably about 7 or 8 different businesses to varying degrees. The one I'm spending a lot of time on is a company called Mr. Lee's Noodles, which is a healthy pot noodle with smart vending machines. So there's the food side, the food, I guess, the tech element of that, and then all the data analytics and all that come around from the smart vending machine. So it's a bit of an ecosystem play, so it's quite exciting. There's another business called Pasta Evangelists, which is a direct-to-consumer business with sort of, high-end pasta delivered through your letterbox. And they've also got a new concession in Harrods recently, back in October. So it's blending the direct-to-online world with real bricks and mortar now. So it's very exciting in terms of seeing how these worlds colliding and how we actually work between the two. And then there's a number of other things that are around everything from a company called Cheerfy, which does customer engagement loyalty through Wi-Fi, Ambi, which is music technology, a bunch of other things.
Wow. It's just making my brain explode. So the food tech sector has seen an explosion in disruptive new technologies over the past few years. Now, given your background as an entrepreneur and investor, what is it that's making the food tech space so interesting and appealing for investment?
So I guess from my perspective, I look at it as it's an exciting sort of stage we're at, because for the first time, more recently, the last, 5 to 10 years or something like that, where we're starting to see the internet disaggregating food in a way that hasn't happened before. So if you think about high streets, you used to have HMV, you used to have all these, lots of Comets, lots of, PC Worlds, all sorts of, white goods, electronic goods, lots of fashion. But those businesses, those retail businesses, have been disaggregated by internet in the last, 10, 15 years. And you're seeing, this whole shift, no more HMV stores, you're streaming through Spotify. there's a lot fewer sort of white goods businesses and things like that. And even fashion has gone very much online, with Net-a-Porter and Farfetch, all these things.
Absolutely.
So food has only recently, relatively recently, been able to, you haven't been able to email food. So, you've always, I guess as a bricks and mortar sort of operator, we've always said, customers still have to come to us and eat with us if you wanted something great. But now with Deliveroo, Uber Eats, all these delivery sort of companies, that world is changing. And I guess it's a start of what I see as a 20 to 50 year sort of fundamental structural shift in how we deal with and interact with food. But this is much broader than just obviously bricks and mortar. This goes everything from your food labs, from the agriculture side of things, how you produce food with lab grown food, all the way to the way you sort of consume it and then the way you interact with it.
That's a really good point, actually, in terms of what does food tech mean to you, I suppose. Chris has just explained what it means to him. Same kind of answer, Alessia, in terms of food tech?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I think it's too early to come up with a kind of universal definition of what food tech is all about. However, I think an interesting way of looking at it is by just, I guess, acknowledging that, you know, tech has touched the food industry in a way, deeper way than just machinery.
Yeah.
Which I believe was the original, more traditional sort of definition of food tech, is anything, you know, that process or it, to some extent, you know, transform, you know, food from an ingredient to a physical product. I think as technology is now touching the whole supply chain, you know, from farm to fork, then the definition should reflect, if you will, you know, that sort of broader, you know, approach, right? So again, it can span from, you know, consumer apps that help, you know, users to find healthier alternatives when it comes to, you know, meals, all the way through, you know, precision farming tools that actually help farmers to effectively manage their fields. So again, it's so broad at this point that I think a lot of people actually struggle to even, you know, understand what, you know, what is food tech and what is not food tech.
Yeah, absolutely. Zina, what do you think?
Well, I agree with both opinions. I would just say that I think the reason why the whole revolution was a bit late when it comes to the food industry is the fact that food is complicated. Food is difficult as an industry. It had its own requirements and levels of complexity. And it took us a while to understand what are the issues with food, what are the questions that we were trying to answer. And I think we've now reached a point where we've do have the technology available, so we do have the solutions, but we also know what the main challenges are. And the fact that we can combine the two makes it a really good point in time where we can utilize the solutions, put them to work, and bring value to the consumer. So it absolutely makes sense that it was a bit later than IT technology, for example, or travel, that are a lot more advanced when it comes to e-commerce. But again, food is part of our everyday life, so it was bound to happen.
Absolutely. Alessia, looking at your website, I thought that the food tech tracking map was particularly brilliant. Tell us about Forward Fooding.
Thank you, Jo. Well, Forward Fooding is the world's first collaborative platform for the food and beverage industry. What that means is, on the one end, we connect large corporates with established startups and scale-ups to enable collaborations among the two. And on the other hand, one of the things that we actually do is we try to keep up with, you know, all the innovation that's happening out there, primarily in FMCG and food tech and ag tech.
Yeah.
What we build with the Global Food Tech Map is nothing but a mapping tool that actually helps any intended user to navigate the global food tech ecosystem.
It's so fun.
When it comes, yeah. I can tell you, it's been quite challenging to build it from the ground up. But yeah, it's absolutely an interesting tool for us as well to really understand what is happening out there. Interestingly enough, we launched it, I think, about 9 months ago. And we've been getting from different users, which actually now span from entrepreneurs all the way through investors, corporate executives, and even representatives from governments, that actually people have been using it for different reasons. Entrepreneurs have been using it primarily to conduct market research about their competitors, which I think is what any entrepreneur should be doing. Corporate executives and investors, I guess, use it to spot new companies that they might be interested in engaging with. And even, you know, government representatives have used it to actually map out, you know, what's happening in their ecosystem at the local level and really understand, you know, whether there is some schemes, for instance, that could be developed at the government level to support some of these businesses. So interestingly enough, we see that a number of different governments are really trying to position their countries as a great testbed for some of these technologies. And I think that is really interesting, as it can really drive, you know, change quite massively.
And what are you seeing as the global food tech trends?
Well, difficult to pin down. Again, we started with a very bottom-up approach. So we were trying to really first, I guess, make the whole, you know, ecosystem more understandable, right, to human beings as us. So we started actually with 10 micro categories with the first version, and then we shrink it down to 8 as we figured actually by getting feedback from users that some of those macro categories could have been combined with other ones.
Right.
So now we have shrink it down to 8, and they span from smart appliances that could go into anybody's kitchen to processed food, whether it's a smart blender or an IoT-connected stove, all the way through what we call next generation food and drink, which is nothing but new ingredients such as insects, such as biotech act ingredients, whether it is lab grown meat or alternative proteins, through actually what AgTech is all about, which is, you know, anything from precision farming all the way through any tech solution that, I guess, creates efficiencies for how farmers have been, you know, interacting with their fields through tech.
Okay.
So, again, I don't think there is a one major trend besides the obvious ones, like alternative proteins. I mean, plant-based, I think, is the major trend. And then the sort of manifestation of that in the food tech world is people effectively coming up with different solutions to replace animal proteins with actually plant-based proteins.
Yeah.
Or, you know, robotics, I guess, is obvious, you know, is from fields to actually restaurants, right? Tech can actually empower restaurateurs as well as farmers to effectively better manage, you know, their operations. And therefore, again, that's another obvious one. But it's changing so fast that I think it's very difficult, at least for me, to really...
It's really exciting there.
You know, rank them into, yeah.
Lots of nodding from Chris over there. Any thoughts on trends, anything that you're seeing specifically coming through?
Yeah, I guess I have a slightly different view to Leslie. I think it is very wide. But it goes back to that food tech definition.
Yeah.
I think, when I was looking at food tech as well, there wasn't any single definition. So we've ended up having to create our own. And partly because I'm speaking at a bunch of conferences about the future of food tech, I've had to literally come up with a definition that works. And the one that I effectively use, and it also frames actually how I view food tech actually, in terms of where you can play. And the way I describe it is that food tech is any technological innovation anywhere along the whole food value chain that can potentially disrupt the way we produce, consume, and interact with food. And with that, that gives you a view of the spread of things. And it's, you know, one sentence.
Whereas there we go, you've done else, it. Prizes to Chris there.
Whereas everything else I've seen is about, like, you know, three slides and so on. So if you want to break it down, you think of it as, you know, the produce part is farm and lab to plate. The consume part is plate to fork. And what I call the interact with is fork to thoughts. Mm-hmm. So the thoughts part is your memory, your interaction and sense and all that sort of stuff. So everything around AR, VR, all that sort of stuff, all the, you know, sense tricking, you know, you smell something and it's blue and it sounds and it tastes better and all that sort of stuff, that comes into that sort of interact with food. And that's sort of how you remember an experience. So there's a lot of things happening in the food world around competitive socializing. You know, things like, urban golf, you know, there's new sort of ways of doing bingo, axe throwing and all that. You know, using bits of tech. So that feeds into that sort of consume part. That sort of interact with. So I guess I use that as the view, and I have a view of what food tech is, you know, where it's heading. And effectively, I'm looking at trends within each aspect of that. So on the producing side, you've got a whole bunch of things around the lab, you know, the things like the alternative proteins on lab-grown meat. There's something interesting that I heard the other day about a company in Singapore that is doing lab-grown prawns. That's exciting because everyone's trying to do meat, right?
Yeah.
Steak, beef, but that's really hard.
you know, you've got muscles and tendons, and trying to do a piece of steak is difficult. But with shrimp or prawn, you've got a consistent sort of, I guess, texture, if you like, which makes it a little bit easier. So that's pretty exciting. And then yeah. you've got all the insect stuff, which I'm less personally interested about.
Yeah, I mean, I slightly glossed over that, but in my head I was thinking, did he really say that? Are we eating insects?
We are, and they taste great, actually. If you do it the right way, they taste great. Yeah. But then a lot of it's around actually grinding it into, as a protein source,
right.
into other things that we don't even notice it.
Okay.
Right? But then there's everything from like CRISPR technology and a whole bunch of other exciting things on that end. And then you've got all the, you know, the fork to, you know, plate to fork, which is everything around sort of, you know, hospitality tech,
yeah.
And how restaurants are run, delivery systems, and all that sort of stuff. Dark kitchen floats.
So, if we're seeing that much activity across the globe, what are some of the biggest successes, and what do you think is driving the success, Alessio?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. Well, again, difficult to say that, you know, companies are being successful at this. Mm-hmm. Besides the very, again, obvious ones like the Impossible Foods of the world. Which is basically a company that has managed to develop plant-based beef patties mm-hmm. with no beef, effectively.
And still question, is that successful, right?
Yeah, well,
it's doing very well.
Yeah, it's doing very well. But again, I think we need to define what success, you know, looks like here first. And I don't think, actually, there's a definition, again, for that, as it's so new. I mean, I don't think there is, at least I don't have historical sort of facts to back, you know, my my statement.
Maybe I rephrase the question as what's doing well in
yes,
your opinion?
Yes, so doing well, yes, for sure. I mean, again, besides the obvious ones like Impossible Food, like Beyond Meat, they've been all kind of, you know, now they've been around for, I think, 7+ years.
Okay.
And they managed to actually develop products that are fully commercializable and scalable. I guess the one, at least on this side of the pond, that I'm particularly excited about are, I think they can be divided into two macro categories. One are the ones that are creating effectively through tech efficiencies up and downstream in the supply chain. So anything from precision farming or what some people have been referring to farm tech. Technologies.
Yeah.
So really technologies that help the farmers and nobody else. And they are designed oftentimes around their needs. So anything from, you know, using drones to map fields mm-hmm. or all the way through better managing byproducts of the farm. And then the second macro category is what I define as tech solutions that enhance food experiences, which goes back, I think, to what Chris was referring to. And there, I mean, I've seen, for instance, blockchain-based solutions that help actually consumers to get full traceability of the supply chain of the products that they actually buy. And I think that is really interesting, as it doesn't only give, you know, data points to consumers, which, as we all know, I guess, you know, have become a lot more skeptical about what labels say. And again, I think technology now allows actually companies to do that, right? Because you can also get the information into the ledgers of the blockchain or in whatever other, you know, tech system in a completely different way as, you know, just printing it out on a label, right?
Yeah.
So those, I think, are the ones that are a little bit more mature now for everyone to refer to as successful companies, if
yes.
that makes sense.
It does. It does make absolute sense. But Chris and Alessio, with such a fast pace of change and new disruptors coming into the scene on an almost daily basis, what approach do you take to keeping on top of the innovation and identifying who to back?
I have this view, I guess, of what food tech is. And a lot of it is actually stuff that I'm personally interested in. And placing in where I can add value in terms of my own sort of background and so on, in terms of startups and so on. So I'm placing bets, if you like, along that sort of spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Meeting a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of the time I'm actually just helping entrepreneurs, you know, giving back a little bit of experience that I've gained over the years. And in that you always learn something anyway, and it's always fascinating to meet, you know, the new ideas that come out. You know, hanging out with Alessio as well, other people in the food tech, in the food tech space. You know, Alessio's great at curating all the, you know, what's happening. You know, he's on top. He's got the pulse of what's going on. So, you know, quite often, you know, when we chat, you know, I'll hear what's going on as well, and I look not only within, I guess, the UK, but also what's going out, you know, around the rest of the world, but also in other aspects where it's not necessarily food related. So one of the areas I spend time in is in education and edtech. And interestingly, I've been quite surprised at how much of the edtech space that I'm asking, you know, things I'm learning in there that I'm bringing back into the food side. I mean, I'm doing a lot the other way, you know, as I would expect with food experience into the education and edtech side. But the other way, it's been great. So I'm getting insights that I would not have otherwise, you know, sort of been able to understand or see if it hadn't been, if, you know, one was just looking at food and food tech.
Yeah.
So it's a whole number of things. And I spend a lot of time doing new product development. So one of the fun parts, I say, of the job of, you know, running Crush was coming up with all the new food, you know, every season, you know. And between Nick, my ops director, you know, when we were running the business, he's still there. The two of us came up with pretty much all the food. And, you know, we put on 100 odd products a year, over 13 years, well over 1,000 products we've launched, created, you know, and seen how they've gone.
Yeah.
That part of the NPD, you know, I guess I spend now a lot more time doing. That was 1% of the job of Crush. But now I get to play around. And I'm playing across a number of different sort of areas on NPD in food. So that, you know, that act of being constantly looking at innovation and being at the cutting edge of stuff means that, you know, you're getting a view of, you know, what's interesting, what the trends are coming.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Alessio?
Well, yeah, I mean, as Chris said, I think it's so new, this space, that unless you really embrace a collaborative approach to how you also keep up with innovation, meaning, you know, talking to people constantly in the space and, you know, referring businesses to each other when, you know, you can maybe help more than, you know, just keeping kind of like that secret sort of for you, right? Is very much what we do at Forward Fooding and how we actually keep up with it. The other big source of sort of like streams of innovation actually comes from data intelligence tools that we've built over the years. So we have taken a very data-centric approach when it comes to that, meaning we have effectively developed proprietary databases over the years that help us to capture the latest innovations that are coming out of the space by, well, parsing any information that is on the web. But I have to say that a lot of it actually comes from, you know, manually adding some of these businesses that we stumble upon at conferences, at events, at attending a number of pitching events at within university labs, where actually most of these innovations, you know, especially the very early stage one, actually happen. So
it's encouraging to know that you do actually have to have like face-to-face contact with humans, and it doesn't all just turn into a robot-led society. I wish that everyone could see these guys, the enthusiasm, and just it's really exciting. There's lots of gesticulation and smiling, and they're loving it. Me too. Zina, I hope you're grinning over in Greece as well. So consumers are making more environmentally conscious decisions, especially in what they consume. We're seeing a lot of innovation from entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley and meeting some of the food challenges that this presents with products that perhaps push the boundaries of acceptability beyond meat, just egg, just two examples of innovation from the science lab. So what role does food tech play in helping solve the gap in the market for alternative meat and dairy products? Chris?
Yeah, I think it plays a significant role. Right. I wouldn't say it's the be-all and end-all. I mean, if we understand what food tech originally meant. So, I mean, we're going back 20 years ago when I was at university. So I did food manufacturing engineering. Food tech really was around process technology, about making food more efficiently, you know, and you know, sort of improving ingredients, you know, adding vitamins, all that sort of stuff. Now it's, you know, this part of food tech you're applying to plant-based meats, all this sort of cellular ag, cellular meat, and so on. There's an interesting dilemma here, because if you look at Impossible Burgers, you know, Impossible Meat and Beyond Burgers and so on, on one hand, yes, they are plant-based. On one hand, yes, there's no harm element. So vegetarians, you know, can embrace it, or vegans, arguably, potentially. However, the actual product itself is highly processed.
Mm.
Right. You know, Impossible Burgers can't come into Europe because it doesn't meet some of the, I think, the FDA equivalent, you know, sort of regulations,
yeah,
because of the soy that's in it, the soy heme and things like that. So there's question marks on that, because if you look at, you know, the younger generation that's coming through, it's all around transparency, sustainability, as well as, you know, the whole vegan movement the last year or so,
yeah,
has been very much driven, you know, it used to be a fad and fringe. Now it's come mainstream because of the environmental impact of things and how it's all driven around a lot around, you know, the UN saying we need to feed, you know, 9 billion people by 2050. How do we do that? And meat, you know, and the harm that's involved with that and environmental impact isn't going to get us there.
Yeah.
Hence looking at all this, so all these alternatives. But you have elements where they're highly processed, and that sort of slightly messes up with the way we think about it, you know,
yeah,
at least this new generation is thinking about it. Then you've got the flip side, which is cellular meat, where you've got a lab-grown piece of steak, for example. Now, I think we were in Sweden, and we heard one of the startups who was creating lab-grown meat, and the founder was a vegan, and she was saying that, actually, this is really interesting, because what's the impact going to be on vegans in the future? Because most vegans are eating it because of harm and environmental issues.
Yeah.
Now, if you solve that with lab-grown meat, will they eat meat?
Will they eat meat? Yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, it throws a number of interesting dilemmas. So all this stuff around, you know, the food tech, you know, there's a huge part that comes into how we, how it plays a big part into food tech, but it's not so black and white, is what I'd say.
Okay.
So one of the issues we have when it comes to environmental challenges is the fact that when food is wanted, it's not produced. So there's always an issue that there is demand for a certain type of food in a specific area, and then the food is offered elsewhere. And it takes the cost of transportation is obviously high, and that causes an environmental issue. If we utilize technology to be able to produce where food is needed, so answer demand directly, we tackle issues like food waste, and we also enable consumption where production lies. There's an opportunity there, and there's a different way of thinking technology if you look at it this way.
Yeah, that's a bit like vertical farming, I guess.
Yes.
You know, rather than being in the fields, you can bring vertical farming into urban environments, so you can grow your own food in your apartment or on the side of a building.
Exactly. Yeah. Or to places, you know, where you wouldn't normally have a type of production because of the local conditions, you may now be able to produce those items.
It's almost like a return to like a really basic standard of living, but with a high technological value.
Yes,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And if I can jump in on that, actually, I think food tech can play a major role in also helping consumers to shift their behaviors. Right. But I see that will happen in two sort of different ways. One that is more short term and easier for consumers to rub their head around. Mm-hmm. And I guess a practical example of that could be, you know, a consumer apps that helps you to pick up, you know, food that is about to be thrown away.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a restaurant or from a retailer. That, you know, is not really changing our behavior that much, or better yet, we know how to use apps to do a number of different things. You just apply that same piece of technology to help consumers to shift their behavior, right? And that, I think, you know, is relatively easy to be embraced. And also things like, you know, the impossible foods of the world. Again, it might be highly processed, and some people might refer to it as that's not any better than meat, mm-hmm, to me as a consumer. But again, there are vegetable-based burgers out there, mm-hmm, that, you know, can easily, effectively be seen as alternative to beef. And Impossible Food is another alternative, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's easier, I think, for consumers to wrap their head around it and change their behavior. Then there are things like, you know, the more biotech-y side of things, you know, when it comes to synthesization of proteins or things that people don't know really. And I think, again,
I guess an example there is spirulina, which is an algae.
Yes.
I mean, yesterday I was eating these little snacks that now are actually available in a number of different retailers here in the UK that are actually spirulina-based, and they're breadsticks, right?
Yeah.
Again, is a new sort of flavor, right, that if you then understand the health side of it and the benefits, then it's relatively easy, right, for you to include it in your diet. Sorry. Then there are things like, you know, I don't know, heme, or the people don't know heme is one of the component of Impossible Food Burgers.
Right.
That, you know, if you don't know it, if you don't know what it is, you might be skeptical. And I guess cellular meat is the perfect example. God knows what goes into making it, right? So I think it will take a while until we actually see people embracing this kind of innovations because they understand fully the benefits that actually this innovation can bring to them.
And the flip side is understand what the risks are, you know, of something new like this. You don't know what the downside risk is.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And with that in mind, what developments are we seeing? What innovations, such as 3D printed food I've been reading about, personalised nutrition, that kind of thing?
I love that stuff.
it's fascinating.
But again, you know, if you look at 3D printing, for instance, I don't think is an innovation in its own terms, in the sense that for people who have been working in the industry for a while, they all know that 3D printing is the sort of reverse engineered way of using extrusion.
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, we've been eating extruded products.
I think it's more than that, though.
Yeah, it enhances the experience. And
it's partly that. I guess the 3D food printing, I mean, you know, we're talking about Fudini partly. Yeah. You know, I love Fudini in terms of what they can do. And again, I've been looking at 3D printing for 20 years, but more on the plastic, you know, engineering side.
Yeah.
And I always thought at some point, you know, you'd have one in your home because you would start making little toys and all that. That's never going to happen, I don't think, in reality. 3D food printing may well, actually, because actually there's a wider part around that where if you imagine that you have one in your home where you can actually control what goes into it. So you have allergies, you're a celiac, you're gluten-free, and then it's when you get to a point where it's IoT connected and you have different recipes uploaded. So you could literally go home and have your, you know, pizza printed out, you know, that your kids would eat, you know, well, my kids would eat in terms of, like, you know, spinach base or, you know, all that sort of funky stuff. That ability to sort of project in the future, I think, becomes quite interesting. The other part of it that I'm particularly interested in, the 3D food printing, is what is it like in terms of for hospitals and care homes and all that.
Yeah.
So if you imagine that, you know, I'm in a hospital bed next to you and you've got your own ailment, everyone's got different sort of makeup and so on, but the food that we're served at the moment, kill you just eating it. You know, slop, you know, you throw it out. But if you imagine that actually you get delivered exactly what you need with the right nutrients, the right benefits and functional benefits on that, and it looks good and tastes good, and there's no waste.
And that makes a lot more sense.
That becomes really interesting when you start replicating out on a sort of larger scale. So that side of things, I'm super interested in. And because of all the crutch stuff on healthy eating, you know, on sort of personalized nutrition, there's a gap at the moment. So there's one of the themes I'm interested in. And if you look at your Fitbit or the old Nike Fuel Band, all that sort of stuff, you can track roughly your exercise, your movement. It's a relative thing. It's not, you know, 100% accurate, but at least on a relative basis, it works.
Mm.
But all this sort of stuff, what's missing, though, is that when you're trying to track what you eat, you know, whether it's with MyFitnessPal, LifeSum, all these apps, there's a reality that actually we don't, as humans, put down what we eat properly.
Yep.
So there's this massive gap. And until we solve that in a similar way, in a simple way that works a bit like the, you know, Fitbit, where it's automated, we have this gap in personalized nutrition. And that's hence the opportunity is there. You know, how, you know, people talk about, you know, sort of sweat patches and breath analysis and, you know, stents in your bloodstream, whatever. But I think with that part, we're a little way away from. But
there
if we solve that, it becomes interesting.
Innovators, there's a gap. There's a gap right there.
There's a gap.
Somebody jump in it. Chris and Alessio, what advice would you give to startups in the food tech space looking to win investment?
Ooh, that's one for you, Chris.
Well, I think what I like to see at least is a strong enough vision of what the business is going to be. a founder that is... another thing that's useful is having a co-founder, I think. Doing it by yourself as a founder, a sole founder, is possible, but it's more challenging. Mm-hmm. So having a good co-founder and a strong team is, you know, all the basic things is important. I think building up a good set of investors and advisors, that actually makes a difference in the things that I'm involved in. Where we have that, where you've got a good set of, you know, investors as well as advisors, a balanced set of advisors, I'd say, you can go much further, much faster. And that's where the value comes in. Mm. I think I've seen situations where, the founders kept things quite tight and narrow and actually acts as a brake as to how fast they can go. Yeah. So I think there's a bit of a balance. So that then sort of goes back to the founder's individual sort of nature. And I think it's important to have that, you know, all the stuff that makes, you know, that make great entrepreneurs, you know, that strong vision, but you know, that perseverance, all these things. But integrity is a big thing. Mm-hmm. But also that ability to listen and actually take on feedback. And I think there's that fine balance between a founder or an entrepreneur that just blindly goes and just goes versus one that really is constantly has a very clear direction of where they're going, but then having the ability to understand, okay, there's new information, how do I incorporate that into the thinking and adjust the path? That part, you know, I think is important. And then the other part of looking, you know, at a team and a founder is their ability to get shit done. So execution is everything. You know, everyone's got loads of ideas. It's about getting it done.
So, Alessio, Forward Fooding works with large corporates to match their needs with potential startups and SMEs. Where are corporates looking to invest?
Wow, that's a that's a big question, I guess. Let's say corporates alongside very established food manufacturers, they all come with very different needs, I think. And it very much boils down to, well, their core business, I guess. You know, if you take a company that makes meat, has completely different needs compared to a company that is producing, you know, mass market products, right? Mm-hmm. I think in general, there are three main sort of areas that we see that everyone is interested in. First one is digital. And how digital is transforming effectively how we actually source food as consumers, and how we do interact with these brands, right? There is this sort of like new, group of brands called digital native vertical brands that actually start from day one, you know, building the relationship with their customers from digital platforms or from digital channels, right? An example is Grace, who was recently actually acquired by Unilever, ironically enough. What they've nailed was really, you know, starting from pure online business. You know, they'd never, I think, intended from the very beginning to be stocked in any of the major retailers. Now, of course, you know, one of the benefits of that is that you build a direct relationship with your customers and mm-hmm. consumers. Therefore, you can create way better NPDs,
yeah.
as you can put, you know, their needs at the core of the development of your products, and a number of other, you know, benefits such as activating your online sales channels when you need it, you know, and not, you know, kind of letting everyone else kind of playing also with your brands, right? This is one that everyone is looking at, I think.
Yeah.
The role of digital.
The whole D2C thing, absolutely.
D2C, which is direct to consumers, and how you can actually build brands that are digital native. It's a huge challenge for most of these large corporates, as most of their people, you know, still struggle to actually rub the head around, you know, why a business like Grays was then sold to 150 million, you know? Then the other, I think, major trend is, or let's say, area of interest for kind of everyone is new business models, which kind of touched also a little bit on how you digitally, you know, effectively activate your brand,
yeah.
which is a model, is subscription, is I don't know how you use a digital platform to actually create a new revenue stream using, for instance, data, which is what Zina just mentioned earlier, right? Data is a currency, effectively. And if you can understand how to capture this data, turn it into insights, and even potentially, you know, sell it at some point to somebody else, that's a new piece of your business model that you can then, you know, effectively also leverage for any other brands of your portfolio, right? But I think that the difficulties there is first getting people to rub their head around how to master, you know, this new sort of way of doing business. And secondly, building effectively pieces of tech or, you know, infrastructure that can actually support the development of these business models across the whole company. And that is, I think it boils down to culture, which is the hardest, I guess, thing in any industry to change. And especially, you know, when you deal with businesses that have hundreds of thousands of employees, then, you know, the changes you need to spark is massive and is so slow, you know, to be profused about around the company. So that is a massive, I think, challenge that a lot of corporates look at now. And the third one is how you differentiate yourself in the long haul from your competitors, right? Yeah. So if you take, for instance, the meat industry, which I guess by now is one of the ones that have been affected the most by the plant-based trend, is how you reimagine your company as a meat manufacturer to remain competitive in the long haul. And of course, you know, there are bets there that are in speculations, right, around whether, you know, we're going to be eating the same amount of meat in 50 years from now. I personally doubt.
No.
But, you know, companies who have put all their sort of eggs into the meat basket, right?
I see what you did there.
It's a bit of a food pun here. They're struggling to understand, you know, what is going to be their next cash cow, right?
Another one, cash cow.
Is it going to come from meat, or is it going to come from maybe a plant-based alternative? Or it might just be that they need to reimagine completely their business. And, you know, Tyson Food will become maybe a biotech company that produces ingredients for food tech businesses, you know what I mean?
It's just enormous, isn't it? And finally, Chris, as an investor, what do you consider to be the key areas of investment for startups at the moment and in the future, and where are you looking to put your money?
Well, actually, a lot of matches with what Alessio's saying. So if we talk about the D2C sort of space, that part I'm very interested in, part of the reason why stepping out of a bricks and mortar business, you know, when I look at sort of any sort of business, I'm excited when they understand, well, they have to understand the impact and the importance of the D2C channel. So as an example here is Pastor Evangelist. They are, you know, one of the kind of digitally native vertical companies that Alessia is talking about. They started, you know, a couple of years ago, but they've now already moved into bricks and mortar. But the information that they have about their customers in terms of data, in terms of behavior, is so much further advanced than a typical bricks and mortar business. And it will overtake it very, very, you know, most bricks and mortar businesses very, very quickly. And you backfill into actual bricks and mortar.
Yeah.
So if you look at Made.com as an example in furniture, you know, they've built it an online business. Now what they're doing, they're taking bricks and mortar showrooms and so on.
Yeah.
There's loads of examples like that in other industries. This is happening in food now. So, you know, that ability to understand the customer. I mean, wind a step back. One of the challenges with Crush is that we have, you know, whatever, 50, 60,000 customers a week. And when I was running it, I didn't know who my customers were. Mm. As in, I do and I don't. But compared to an online D2C business who knows exactly when you purchase something, what you purchase, what you're looking at, and so on, there's a big gap. And one of the reasons why I got involved with Cheerify is because that sort of leveled a little bit of the gap. It allows you, almost like creating a Nectar card, you know, a large Sainsbury's or Tesco has all that data with the loyalty programs. But us restaurateurs or chain operators that are on a smaller scale, we just don't have that because it's too expensive. So Cheerify partly sort of levels that playing field, allows you to understand your customer through Wi-Fi engagement and profiling a lot better. But then if you then combine that with like the D2C model,
where you really do understand, and back, you know, that becomes exciting. With Mr. Lee's Noodles, where we have the data part, so the second part that Alessia's talking about, in terms of data, you know, we have the ability, you know, when we have the data analytics around the smart vending machines, is to understand, you know, sort of a bit like Minority Report, is what I say.
Yeah.
You know, Tom Cruise walks by and there's different ads, you know, that are, you know, hi, Mr. Cruise, you know, whatever. There's an element where you can actually serve, you know, serve the right ads and so on and the right information to a customer. But also when the customer's not there, it acts as a footfall counter, so you understand actually who's walking by and who's interacting. So if you imagine something like a Sodexo or a Compass, which has 10,000 locations around the UK, you know, hospitals, schools, universities, corporate offices, all of a sudden you can start having data as to actually roughly what is the demographic? Mm. You know, what are the demographics of all the different locations? That information, that data layer, becomes super valuable, super interesting. So I think both of those things are really interesting. I'm looking at things around, like Zeno was saying, around AI as well. There's a couple of businesses I'm looking at that are using AI for food specifically. Early days yet, but it's super interesting. So and that's about efficiency. So it's all about efficiency of understanding. So robotics and AI, that sort of stuff. Efficiency back of house, efficiency with your customer marketing and so on. And if you're not in that, at some point you're gonna you know, basically be behind. The other part that's worth considering is what happens when 5G comes into this. So 5G all of a sudden makes all these IoT, Internet of Things, you know, all these devices are super connected, super. So then that generates a hell of a lot of information, a lot of data. Bit scary. But again, that information then informs and allows NPD cycles to be much more quick, much faster, and also much more effective to what customers want. So whole bunch of stuff.
Wow. Well, Chris, Zena, Alessio, thank you so much for joining me. The future of food is exciting. You guys, with your enthusiasm and your products at the forefront of it, I think it's something we've all can look forward to. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That brings us to the end of our Table Talk podcast. I hope that you've all learned as much as I have. Join us next time for more conversations on industry innovation, groundbreaking technologies, and insight from the global community changing the future of food and drink.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.